This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 1203. It's great to have you with us for the Wednesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. A really hot and humid day in Chicagoland. Lots of sunshine right now, though. We're heading to a high of 93 with a chance for some thunderstorms in the area later this afternoon. Right now, 88 O'Hare, 89 Midway, and also 88 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. On today's Noon Business Hour, we'll get into all of that and dig deep on some retirement spending issues. Personal Finance Wednesday, how to avoid that spending spree when you first retire. Also, McDonald's looking to lure some chicken lovers away from Chick-fil-A. Netflix dealing with the loss of another hugely popular show. We'll cover that in our next segment. Right now, the chair of the Fed speaks and markets are reacting. To talk about it, we're joined by Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at Smart Portfolios based in San Diego. Jim, what do you make so far of what the Fed chair is saying to Congress?
Well, I think he eliminated some of the doubt, if you will, as to whether or not the Fed will move at the July meeting. Predominantly, Cisco, he focused more on the things that are concerning the Fed, namely the slowdown in global growth, the uncertainty regarding trade, that and the impact on business investment, as opposed to, gee, the unemployment rate is at a 50-year low, consumer spending is decent. So I think he tipped his hand, Cisco, and the odds are, I think, more conclusive that the Fed will, in fact, move at their July 31st meeting.
So is the question now, as you're saying, not whether the Fed will move, but just how much it might move?
Yeah, I mean, I personally would only expect 25 basis points. The Fed, you know, with the federal funds rate at around 2.5, they only have 9 quarter-point moves. So they kind of have to use each one wisely. Plus, because of the trade uncertainty, I think the Fed will want to, if President Trump moves forward, if the trade talks collapse, President Trump enacts another 10% tariff on the remaining $300 billion of imports that are not subject to tariffs, I think the Fed will act aggressively, Cisco, and potentially move 50 basis points at that point in time. So I suspect the Fed will go 25 basis points in July and wanting to hold back so that if the tariff war escalates, they can move more aggressively at that point.
And does the data support that sort of a rate cut? Obviously, the White House has been pressuring the Fed a lot. Yeah. Is this at all because of that pressure, or do you think the data supports it?
Well, the domestic data, in my opinion, does not support it. The weakness has been concentrated in manufacturing because of the trade war. So you look at the ISM survey number, it's a little bit below 52. Back in 1995, when the Fed cut rates, it was closer to 45. But I think the uncertainty regarding the tariffs that we've already seen, has clearly slowed global growth, and trade represents about 25% of global GDP. So those are, you know, consequential issues, and I think the Fed is looking at this as a, if you will, the insurance cut, as opposed to, gee, looking at the U.S. economy, does it warrant it? Probably not, but looking at the broader scope, I think the Fed is leaning toward moving.
Yeah, just to be on the safe side. Thank you, Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at Smart Portfolios. You can check out Jim's website, macrotides.com. We've learned this week the hugely popular Friends TV show will be leaving Netflix next year. And that follows word that Netflix is also losing The Office. That'll be gone by 2021. What will happen to Netflix in the wake of this? Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verter Group here in Chicago, is joining us. Two big shows are leaving Netflix, Tim. First question, is this at all a surprise that these moves are being made?
No, certainly not. These are entities that are owned, produced originally in the studios by these entities. In the case of AT&T, which now owns Warner Brothers, that's the Friends scenario. So that's Friends basically coming back home to where it was originally produced, the Warner Brothers lot. And the same for a lot of these other shows, as NBC Universal and Viacom and Disney and all these other entities now essentially are creating their own distinct streaming services. You're going to see a lot of these originally produced programs and go back to, at least on paper, go back to these now owned and operated services, becoming very vertically integrated, much maybe to the dismay of the consumer who may not necessarily understand where and what studios these shows came from. They just want to watch them all, and then all of a sudden have now realized that they have to subscribe maybe to four or five or six different services in the years to come versus one or two.
Well, and is that sustainable? I mean, are you going to have consumers who are subscribing to five, six, seven, eight different services just so they can get all their favorite shows? I mean, it's almost as though they should just go back to cable.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting perspective, Cisco, because that may be what we're sort of seeing in slow yet fast motion, is almost a decomposition, I guess, of what the cable conscript was. You subscribe to a cable service, the provider has an array of choices, you get them in packages and bundles, and you pay a one monthly fee for all of those things. As things now become more, shall we say, unbundled, I think you will see entities like, say, Roku and Amazon and maybe a few other platforms that frankly may be a more intelligent system by which many, many, many more streaming services and choices are available to you that you, as an individual, as a consumer, as a household, can recombine and sort of tally up the cost of such on your own terms. I think that's kind of the next 3 to 5 years out. But in the interim, it's absolutely going to be a pain point for consumers, which is, what show am I really trying to find? And oh my God, what service is that on? And do I subscribe to that already or not? It's going to be very perplexing for the average viewer, for sure.
Given the fact that one of the reasons Netflix was able to get some shows like Friends and The Office is because these other outlets did not already have streaming engines in place, and now that they have them up and running or just about up and running, is there a chance that Netflix will never see some of these network shows in the future?
You know, that's also a very good question. The reality of the television industry, at least until now, has been that many studios provide programs to many different broadcast or television or cable outlets. So there's, you know, a show that you like on ABC Family or on NBC may actually be produced by each other's studios, right? The consumer doesn't understand all that. But I think what you're going to see is a lot more, shall we say, vertical integration, where the studio then almost officially or directly populates the content in said owner's streaming service as well. But I do think there will always be this mixing and matching, because here's the underlying factor. We're only making more stuff. All of these services need, these are beasts that need to be fed with many, many more shows and programs. And somebody's got to make them. And, you know, if they can't sell them or guarantee them in your own nest, your own service, there's going to be tons of other places that you can sell those programs to going forward with streaming services, writ large.
Yeah, really great opportunity for the actors and producers, all the people behind the scenes, too, working on those shows. They're going to need a lot of content. Wall Street basically shrugging Netflix off today. No real movement on the stock, even in the wake of this news. Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Vertair Group here in Chicago, thanks for being with us. Up next, an effort to thwart spying on the U.S. by China. It appears to be falling short.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's likely that an August deadline to remove Chinese-made surveillance cameras from federal agencies will not be met. Let's discuss the potential dangers and the challenges in getting the cameras out of here. Jerry Irvine is joining us, CIO of Prescient Solutions, also a member of the National Cybersecurity Task Force here in Chicago, is where Jerry is based. Jerry, I think a lot of people are not familiar with this. They haven't even heard about the fact that these Chinese-made cameras are supposed to be out of federal agencies. So why don't you begin by just telling us about that? What's that supposed to be about?
Well, the problem that they're having is these cameras, whether they are the actual camera themselves or a component that was made by the Chinese government, are actually going in and hacking the traffic sending the video images, audio images, and even network data back over to China and being captured by the Chinese government. So, and this has been going on and documented since 2005.
And yet the cameras have stayed in these federal agencies all those years, I mean, more than 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, there's even a company that was granted a federal grant to purchase all of their cameras, a U.S., you know, California-based company. And unbeknownst to the government, the California-based company was buying their video chips from China. So even though they went out and bought them from a U.S.-based company, they were still, you know, hacked by the Chinese, by these chips. And the average person that's out there today, if you've got a video camera, your camera most likely has these same chips on it. Probably more than half of the cameras that cost less than $200 were made with these components by Hikvision or Huawei or different Chinese manufacturers that are out there.
And so what is the danger then? I mean, on the federal level, obviously, there's a lot of spying issues that are potential dangers. What about for the consumer, though? As you're mentioning, just about everyone's camera may have something like this.
Well, especially the small to mid-sized businesses that are out there who have security cameras and other types of cameras in their manufacturing plants that are connected to their networks. It gives the Chinese government, again, access to your intellectual property. What do you have being made at your location? What are you communicating? Do they have the ability to get into your financial systems, your data diagrams, all of those different things? It's another back door for the Chinese to get into to your network, the government's network, and basically access anything they want.
But is there any way around it? Because it just seems like the demand for these electronics, whether it's within the government or businesses or just your personal devices, so much of it has been made in China. What if we want to avoid that? Is it even possible?
It's very difficult, as they're even saying about the federal government having a hard time finding these cameras, all of them that have the components, because what happens is these manufacturers of these products go out and buy the cheapest thing they can find. So one day it may be a Chinese chip, the next day it might be a South, you know, American chip or something else. So not all of them have the same components in it. So they literally have to go in and tear apart these devices, you know, physically or logically to determine if they're there. It's very difficult. For us as consumers, I would suggest, you know, having a firewall in your network that does not allow outbound communication without authentication. And what happens, the way the Chinese do this in the federal government, is the outbound communications that they're grabbing, the video streams or the data streams that they have, they encrypt it into a VPN of some sort and send it back. So when the government has their firewalls looking at it, it doesn't look like anything. It just looks like static, more or less. So what they're doing now is they're blocking any encryption for outbound traffic. So there are ways around it, but it's very technical, very difficult. And the average consumer is not going to have the ability to do that.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. We'll keep tabs on it. Thank you, Jerry Irvine, CIO of Prescient Solutions.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Stocks are rallying today. We'll see what's lifting the markets and also look at the prospects of a continuing bull market. McDonald's franchisees call for a new sandwich to compete with a growing competitor. It's Personal Finance Wednesday, staying out of financial danger in the early part of retirement. Taste of Chicago is open in Grant Park under a plan of security and safety presented by the city. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 102 points, the NASDAQ up 61, and the S&P is up 15. Oil today back in the $60 range. It is up nearly 4%. Right now, we have beautiful sunshine. It is a very hot day with lots of humidity as well. 88 at O'Hare, 89 at Midway, and 88 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Markets are gaining ground today. Let's see what's going on. Matt Shapiro is joining us, president of MWS Capital here in Chicago. What do you make of, it's a little boost, but a boost nonetheless on Wall Street today.
Yes, Cisco. Thanks for having me on. 3,000 in the S&P 500. You know, who would really believe that? You know, after the corrections we had in December, the one we had in May, And here we are. And the rally today is really all about the Fed, Jerome Powell and his testimony to Congress, really delivering on a fully priced in quarter point rate cut in the Federal Reserve rate. So that's what's sort of lifting this market after a couple soggy days. And it's pretty remarkable that we're at all-time highs when the talk is, of course, of a slowdown that the Fed is responding to. So something doesn't quite seem right.
And that's, I guess, what I've been scratching my head over, too, because if the Fed is saying it needs to cut rates, that seems to signal that it sees some challenges in the economy. And from a Wall Street perspective, that, of course, might impact earnings.
Right. And I think the reality is, and this is my hypothesis, is that the underlying fundamentals are much better than people think, and that the Fed is just simply backing down to the reality that we haven't escaped all this risk aversion from the financial crisis, something I've talked about a ton with everybody. Realize in Europe, which is a large market about the size of the United States, they have negative interest rates. So all that money and wealth in Europe, which of course has more tepid growth in the United States, eventually filters into the United States Treasury market, where we have these incredibly low yields, which doesn't really reflect, I believe, the pace of growth. So, look out the window here, the beautiful Chicago skyline. There's not a slowdown to be had. We have strong employment, strong companies, strong stocks. So I think we have this really Goldilocks scenario where the rest of the world's caution is creating these exceptionally low interest rates for our more growth-oriented economy. So if you can wrap your heads around that, I think it looks really good for stocks over the next few months.
Couple story stocks we want to talk about. The first one is McDonald's. You have franchisees essentially saying Chick-fil-A is hurting them when it comes to chicken, and they want the corporate office to do something about it.
Yeah, and if you read what the franchisees said, Easterbrook has elevated them into more of a decision-making role, and they need a premium chicken sandwich to compete with Chick-fil-A. Which only has about 2,000 stores, but they really kill it, especially in the Southeast. So that's kind of a little bit of a hole in the menu that the franchisees are expecting to fill. And, just remind me to keep on buying some more McDonald's stock. $212 pays a pretty good dividend. Obviously, it's much higher than when we used to talk about it, when it was sort of a dog of the Dow. But it is just, one of those stocks in this market continuing to power higher and defying expectations.
Yeah, if only you can have a time machine, right? I mean, how many stocks people think they're overvalued and come to find out a couple of years later they're much higher? It happens all the time.
Yes, it does. And, another stock in the news today, this high-flying IPO market, maybe a little bit of reality setting in, is Levi's, down about 10-11% on a tepid earnings report, which, I never had happened to buy Levi's. It was, an IPO went as high as about 23 or so, down about 21 today. Relatively mature company in denim and blue jeans, although they have a lot of momentum in terms of, fashion lately, fashion trends. But, investors need to be a little bit more realistic about a company like that and its growth prospects compared to all the top 50 growth stocks right now, with strong business momentum and strong price appreciation. Many of them are in the IT and cloud computing space. So when you want to talk about rapid growth, that's where it is.
In general, you think that a rate cut is already baked into the market? You expect to see any sort of a significant swing if and when the Fed cuts rates?
I think some investors might be, a little bit more, okay, it's been priced in, what now? And I wouldn't disagree with that. So I think we really do need a good GDP number. We certainly had a good jobs report last Friday, and we also need some really good earnings to justify this market. And then if this quarter point reduction kind of does the trick, I think, the coast could potentially be clear until, of course, the election cycle starts heating up.
It'll be fascinating. Thank you, Matt Shapiro, president of MWS Capital. Up next, Personal Finance Wednesday, making sure the first year of retirement doesn't become a money pit.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday here on the Noon Business Hour. This afternoon, we're discussing the first year of retirement. It can be a dangerous time for the bottom line. We welcome Ed Jurtzen, Certified Financial Planner at Mack Investment Securities here in Chicago, also a past national president of the Financial Planning Association. Ed, I'm imagining these retirees, they've been working hard for 35 or 40 years. They finally get there, and man, all they want to do is start taking some of those trips, right?
Well, and that's sort of the fun part about it, is you've been working so hard, you're working your whole life, and now it's the bucket list. It's what trips do we want to go on, where do we want to kind of spend our money, and that can present some challenges down the line if not approached correctly.
So what is the advice? I mean, I guess first off, just patience, right? I mean, right off the bat, don't just go on a big spending spree.
Well, I think one of the tips is if you have this bucket list to take on trips, maybe start saving that bucket list before you retire. So instead of dipping into retirement principal, you can take that money out of savings that you were being supplemented by your income before retiring, which goes a long way in terms of, again, that financial security.
And what about the budgeting? I mean, no one likes the thought of a budget, but if you have one, if you know how much you're bringing in, if you know how much you have to spend on those necessities, does that then give you some wiggle room to make some of those plans?
Yeah, I'd like to get rid of the word budget, Cisco, and use the word spending plan, because budget reminds me of the word diet. You just want to create a plan. And what we found with clients is when we have them propose a spending plan in retirement, often those numbers are far lower than actually exist. So what we suggest people to do is before retiring, actually live on what your proposed spending plan is in retirement. Oftentimes, we find clients have a difficult time doing that. So be very realistic of your spending and your goals in retirement.
One of the challenges for people is, I mean, I'm just being very frank here, you know, they don't necessarily know when they're going to die. So they don't know if they're planning for a 35 or 40-year retirement or a 10-year retirement. And obviously, behavior is different depending upon what those numbers would be.
You know, I often joke with clients, there's three things for a successful retirement. One, work longer. Two is to spend less, or three is to die sooner. And some people sort of laugh at that. But what you had said, we don't know. We don't know how it's going to end for most people. So there's a balance here, right? You don't want to just be clutching your money because you're nervous about overspending it. You want to approach it with a diligent sort of effort. And a guidance with a good certified financial planner would be very helpful as you sort of guide your way through retirement.
And you touched on not a budget, but a spending plan. If you, whatever it is, $50,000, whatever it is that your annual income is going to be in retirement, if you can comfortably take trips or buy gifts or a new car or whatever with that money, then is the advice sort of go ahead and do it, but don't get beyond that. That's when you get yourself in trouble.
That's great advice. And so the spending gap, how much money you're spending versus how much is coming in, one of the key elements to all of this is don't solely rely on the stock market to fill that gap, because that is what's going to create problems down the line. Just ask retirees who happened to retire in 2007 of that risk that's there. So yes, it's a balance between spending, and then also if you have a part-time job or some other ways to supplement your income other than, let's say, Social Security, always a good idea to have more money coming in, obviously, than going out.
Yeah, good advice. Thank you, Ed Jurtzen, joining us on Personal Finance Wednesday. Ed is a certified financial planner with Mack Investment Securities. This time tomorrow, Technology Thursday. Still to come, can the bull market continue its run?
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Stocks are pushing higher today. Can the forward momentum continue? Let's get the perspective of Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington, D.C. Well, Mark, do you think there's more room to run here?
I think there is. What I did for a column earlier this week for the MarketWatch site is look at the pattern of relative performance of the different sectors of the market. It turns out there's a regular pattern of which sectors do best early, middle, and latter stages of a bull market. And so I looked at all the sectors that typically do the best in the last 3 months of a bull market and then compared it to the actual performance of the sectors and found that there was a lot of difference, which suggests that we probably have more room to run for this bull market.
So what is the advice then? If you're a contrarian, then what do you do if there's more room to run in a bull market?
That's always a great question. The contrarian, I suppose, wouldn't be focusing on the data about the relative performance of the sectors. A contrarian would be focusing on the sentiment. And there, I'd say that from a very short-term point of view, there is some source of concern just because there's a lot of optimism out there in the market, especially as of today when Fed Chairman Powell gave some encouraging words about the possibility of a rate cut, which I think is going to give a boost to the market a little bit. But it's also at the same time created a lot of optimism. And as you and I know from previous conversations, too much optimism is usually not conducive to an immediate pop. But I would say that's a very short-term consideration, whereas the sector performance that I mentioned earlier in our conversation here really is more of an intermediate-term significance. It suggests, are we in the last several months of a bull market? And at least from the point of view of this indicator, we are not at the latter stages. So we, at a minimum, we'd say at a top for this bull market is several months away and maybe even longer.
Is one of the challenges for someone who may be more pessimistic about what's going on the fact that they don't necessarily want to pull it all out and just keep it in cash, and there's not really other good places to get any kind of a yield?
Well, that's a very good point. And I suppose somebody could try to play the different sectors. So, for example, let's say you thought that a bear market was going to happen soon. You might want to avoid the utilities and the financial sectors, which are two sectors that typically do the worst in the latter stages of a bull market. Usually when you're approaching the end of a bull market, the rotation in the market shifts and more of the consumer staple stocks. These are the stocks that represent goods that consumers are probably going to buy even in a recession. For example, we all need soap. That's a classic example, not the only one, of course. And so typically you're going to find consumer staple stocks doing well in the latter stages of a bull market as those stocks anticipate the economic downturn that may be coming down the pike. We're not seeing that right now, but that might be something you would want to play if you were pessimistic, as you say, and saw that the end of the bull market was at hand.
All right. Fascinating to watch this market run. Thank you, Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com. Past programs later today, a podcast of this hour at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Radio.com app.